welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss by Captain J.C. Voss. We're on the second book, called 40,000 Miles Around the World, and we're continuing Chapter 10. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Book 2, Chapter 10, continued. During the second night, the wind gradually died out, and at daybreak the weather was calm and clear. After the large seas had gone down, I went to work to splice the foremast and put everything back in its place, and in the afternoon I was ready for another breeze. I did not have to wait long for it, a moderate breeze coming up the same night. From then I experienced light winds and weather until October the 14th, and when my position was about 150 miles northeast from Sydney, a strong breeze came in from the rear. I kept running before it as long as I thought it safe to do so, but when the wind increased to a howling gale and the seas commenced to break, I hove to in the usual way. I put a light on deck and then turned in, all standing, with all my clothes on, and now and then I would get up and see if the light on deck was burning. About midnight I got up to make sure the light on deck was all right, but to my surprise it was extinguished, and to make matters worse, a green, red, and bright white light appeared ahead. Of course, I knew at once that those were a steamer's lights, and that the vessel was coming straight towards me. There was no time to lose. I had to let the lookout on the steamer know that I was ahead of her, or in another 5 minutes, she would have run me down. I knew that I had no time to fix my light, so pulled off one of my socks, soaked it with kerosene, and set it ablaze. I felt a good deal better when I saw the green light disappearing from my sight. They had seen my signal, and in less than 5 minutes, a large steamer passed by. The gale kept up its fury for 3 days and nights, after which the wind moderated, but as I had seen neither sun, moon, nor stars, and had completely lost my position, I kept the boat under her sea anchor till noon, when I got the position, which put me about 100 miles southeast of Sydney. By that time the wind had died down, and the sea had become quite calm. 2 hours later the sky was as clear as crystal, with the exception of a very heavy cloud rising from the southwest. I watched this as it grew larger and larger. In a little while, when it rose to about 45 degrees above the horizon, it looked like a huge arch supported on the bosom of the ocean, one abutment in the southwest and the other in the southeast, and it certainly appeared as if I was getting into another heavy gale. I therefore secured all my sails and prepared for the storm. But the cloud rose no higher, and while I was looking at it, I saw what appeared to be a long, sharp point forming underneath the centre of the span, which was gradually approached by a similar point rising up out of the ocean, and as soon as the two points met, they formed a large waterspout. I at once made a dive down into my cabin to get my rifle on deck, which did not take longer than half a minute, and by the time I was on deck again, there were two. Then, one after the other, they formed until, in a very short time, there were six, the nearest at the very most 1 mile from me, but there they stopped, and owing to the perfect calm I could hear the water rushing up in the cloud, which sounded something like a distant waterfall. Shortly afterwards one of the spouts broke, then another would rise, and so they kept on rising and falling, one after the other, for about 3 hours. The cloud got larger and larger till 6 o'clock, when the last spout disappeared. I may mention here that I had sailed across the South Pacific several times, and on different occasions I have seen waterspouts, but never before or since have I witnessed spouts of the same nature. All other waterspouts I have seen moved more or less in a slanting position, while those in question were all perfectly vertical. During the afternoon, from about 3 till 6 o'clock, there must have been at least 30 spouts that I saw from my boat, and the nearest at any time I should judge was about 1 mile distant. I fired several shots at the spouts, and one of them broke shortly after I fired, but whether it broke from the effects of the vibration of the shot or from natural consequences, I cannot say. I have been told by shipmasters who have experience with waterspouts that they will break every time from the vibration of a gunshot, or if it is discharged within 200 yards. I, however, was well pleased that they kept where they were, as had they come near my vessel, and had I been unable to break them with my gun, the Tillicum and I might still be sailing in the sky. At 6 o'clock, the bank that had up to then formed a large arch, and by the looks of it had imbibed from the ocean thousands upon thousands of tons of water, broke up and covered the sky in a few minutes with dark and threatening clouds. At the same time, the weather still kept calm, but I heard thunder, and a flash of lightning was followed by a loud peal of thunder, and then I experienced a very severe thunderstorm. There was no wind with it, but occasionally very heavy rain squalls. The lightning was apparently very near my boat, for it would make the dark and cloudy night as bright as day. I knew I was absolutely unable to prevent the lightning from striking my boat, so went below and laid down in my bunk to await further developments. The thunderbolts seemed to be very close to the Tillicum, and I was apprehensive that the next flash of lightning would strike the canoe and put the two of us out of existence. However, nothing happened to me or my boat, and later the thunder diminished until at midnight it stopped altogether. I got up, opened the cabin door, and took a look around. There was then no cloud to be seen anywhere, and the sky was dotted with stars. There was also a light breeze from the southeast, and as I had all the stars I wanted to guide me on my way, I at once got sails on the Tillicum and directed my course for Sydney. The south-easterly breeze kept light during the night, but freshened in the morning. At noon, I had as much wind as I could stand under all sails, and this condition continued until dark, when the breeze gradually moderated, and at 9 o'clock I said to myself, "If my reckoning is right, I should see the Sydney light before long." From that time, I kept looking for the light, and in 15 minutes, sighted it. Chapter 11. Sydney. The wind fell very light towards midnight, and an hour later I was becalmed. Lowering all sails, I laid down in my little bunk and slept till daybreak, when I awoke to the sound of a whistle. I got up, and there was a large tug alongside me. The captain of the tug told me that he had read in the Sydney papers that the Tillicum had left Suva, but owing to the bad weather that had been prevailing on the coast, she had been given up for lost. The captain then asked me if I had seen any vessels outside, and when I answered no, he said that he was going out to look for some. He surmised that there would most likely be an easterly breeze at about 10 o'clock, and then proceeded seaward. My position at that time was about 15 miles from the lighthouse. As the captain had anticipated, it breezed up from the east, and at 2 o'clock in the afternoon I sailed through the entrance of Sydney Harbour, one of the most beautiful harbours in the world. I then shaped my course towards the town. The doctor's boat was soon alongside, and I reported the loss of my mate. He said he would like to come on board and look at my logbook. As there was a strong wind at the time, the doctor did not care to trust himself on the Tillicum. However, after I assured him that I'd come all the way from Victoria in her, and that she was quite safe in Sydney Harbour, he came on board, and after looking round said, "Captain, this is the smallest deep-water ship that has ever entered Sydney Harbour. Some years ago, Captain Slocum called here in the sloop Spray on a voyage round the world. I thought then that she was a very small vessel to undertake such a cruise, but you could have put this one in her cabin." I then showed him my logbook, and satisfied him that the loss of my mate had been an accident, pure and simple, and one that might have happened on the largest and best vessel afloat. Shortly after the doctor left me, I sailed into a small bay on the left-hand side going up towards Sydney, and made the Tillicum fast to a yacht, and went on shore to look up Mr. Luxton. Mr. Luxton and I had an understanding in Suva that he would leave his address in the Sydney post office, and on inquiring there, I found that he was at a hotel in Manly, which is about 7 miles across the harbour from Sydney. A ferryboat leaves Sydney for Manly every 30 minutes, so I boarded the first one available and met Mr. Luxton the same afternoon. On saying goodbye to Mr. Luxton in Suva, I had told him that the distance to Sydney was about 1,800 miles, and that he could look for my arrival in about 18 days' time from the time I left Suva. But as I was 10 days overdue, Mr. Luxton had given me up for lost. On meeting my old mate, he looked at me with astonishment, exclaiming, "Is that really you, John? Are you still alive? Is it possible that you got safely through that bad weather? I thought once that we were going to get lost on the large steamer I came across in, and people here have already given up on you. When I told Mr. Luxton about losing the man who had taken his place in Suva for the run to Sydney, he looked at me for a while and then almost collapsed. When sufficiently recovered, he said, "Well, John, if I had known that such a thing would happen, I would never have left you. I would far sooner have taken chances on my own life than to see someone else die for me. But John," he continued, "after this accident, we must put a stop to our adventure here, sell the boat and go back to Victoria." In a way, I did not blame Mr. Luxton for making such a proposal, and if the accident had happened a day or even a few days before my arrival in Sydney, I should certainly have agreed to his proposal. As it was, I felt so bad after the accident that if a vessel had come along, I would have been only too glad to part with my little craft on the high seas and board her. But owing to the fact that I was all that time alone and had managed to bring the Tillicum safely to land in spite of the bad weather, I had gained so much confidence in her that I felt in my own mind that I should go on and complete the voyage I had undertaken. I told Mr. Luxton that accidents would happen to the best of ships afloat, and as the Tillicum had proved her seaworthiness in all kinds of weather, I could not agree to such a proposal and asked him to fulfil his agreement. Mr. Luxton was a good shipmate in every way and was also a very careful man on board the boat, and I am quite certain that if he had remained on the vessel in Suva and made the trip with me to Sydney, the accident would not have happened. I therefore urged him to continue the voyage to Europe. But in spite of all my pleading, he refused to go on, and so I became the sole owner of the Tillicum and all her fittings. And here, however, as I needed provisions and another mate, and to get these more money than I was in possession of at the time was necessary. After considering the matter, I decided to place my boat and the curios I had collected in Indian villages on the west coast of Vancouver Island and the South Sea Islands on exhibition. I certainly had luck when the mayor of Manly granted me permission to place my outfit on exhibition in Manly Park, near the landing place, where thousands upon thousands of sightseers arrive on the Sydney ferry boats every day. And within 24 hours, I had sailed my little boat across Sydney Harbour to Manly, conveyed her to the park, put a canvas tent around her, placed my collection of curios alongside the boat, and there I was, ready for business. I got all the advertising I wanted from the Sydney papers, and so I thought everything would surely be all right. The next morning, at 9 o'clock, I opened the door and hung up a notice that the Tillicum was on exhibition, admission sixpence. To make the exhibition look attractive, I hung hundreds of photographs of the natives of the South Sea Islands which we had taken all around the outside of the canvas, and decorated the place with flags. The next thing I had to do was to act the part of a showman, and this I soon found was the hardest proposition that I had tackled so far on the cruise, and I very nearly gave it up at the beginning. There was very little doing the first morning. The only customer I had was a woman of I don't know how many winters. She was one of these short, stout ladies, and after paying her sixpence, she stepped on board and sat down in the cockpit. After she had been there for some time, I took heart enough to speak the first word, saying, "Well, madam, how do you like my little boat?" "Like what?" she said. "My little boat," I repeated. "I don't see anything to like about your little boat," she replied. "But when is she going to start?" "Start for where?" I asked. "I don't know," she reported. "You ought to know. I paid you sixpence for a boat ride, and I'm going to have it." "Madam," I explained, "you are mistaken. This boat is not here to ride about on, but on exhibition as a novelty." To my great surprise, the good old lady went off like a stick of dynamite. "Boat on exhibition as a novelty? You must think I'm crazy. I can see hundreds of boats every day in Sydney Harbour for nothing, and you are very much mistaken if you think I have come here to pay you sixpence to see your old boat." The lady kept the floor for quite a while, calling me all kinds of pet names. I stood there listening quietly, for I had an idea that if I said anything, it would only make matters worse. When she got tired of talking, I was only too glad to return her sixpence, which she accepted, and then went out looking as angry as an old hen. This person certainly made me think that I was out of place as a showman, and that the best thing I could do was to sell my outfit and go home with Mr. Luxton. However, the same afternoon at 3 o'clock, the Sydney boat came alongside the wharf, just loaded down with people, and about 5 minutes later, There was hardly standing room left in my place of exhibition. Some of them told me that they had read with great interest in the daily papers all about my adventures. The same night, when I counted my takings for the day, I was quite satisfied that everything would come right, which proved true later on. Before I took my departure from Sydney, I made up my mind that I would not go direct to Europe in my boat, but would also visit some of the largest cities of Australia, New Zealand, Africa, and South America, and then proceed to Europe, calling at different islands as I went along. I might say that I was so taken with Sydney that I stayed there till the middle of January. As I had fully made up my mind to proceed on my voyage, I advertised for a mate, thinking that it might be hard to get one. But to my great surprise, I received dozens of applications from all types of men, and one woman even applied. The latter wrote me a very nice letter, in which she told me that she had been able to see my boat and myself, and that she would give almost anything to make the voyage to Europe in the Tillicum. I answered her letter to the effect that to make the voyage to Europe in the canoe would be very hard on a man, and that it would surely be too much for a woman. A few days later, I received another appeal, in which she said that she had been sailing boats in Sydney Harbour for several years, and that she knew all about a boat and the sailing of one, and pleaded hard that I should take her as my mate. I, however, was obdurate and engaged a younger man of the same type as Mr. Luxton. While I was busy getting ready to sail, I received a letter from the secretary of the Sydney Harbour Board, asking me to call at his office, which I did the following day. On entering and introducing myself, the good gentleman presented me with a bill for £5, representing pilot dues for entering and leaving the harbour, and 3 shillings and some pence for dues. I told this gentleman that I had found my way into Sydney Harbour without a pilot, and that I thought I could find my way out again unassisted. "Pilotage is compulsory," he said, "and it must be paid before you can sail out of this harbour." I promised the secretary I would be in the next day to pay the bill. The following morning, I called at the office and said to the secretary, "I think I owe you £2.10 for pilotage and 3 shillings and a few pence for harbour dues." With that, I placed the money on his desk. The secretary looked at me and added, £2.10 more for going out." "I will pay you that amount before I sail out of your harbour," I assured him. After a few words, he gave a receipt for the money I offered him. I reassured him that I would pay the balance of the pilot dues before sailing out of Sydney Harbour, bade him good day, and left the office. A few days later, I took the train for Newcastle, taking my boat along as baggage, and during my stay there got a permit from headquarters to the effect that I could sail in and out of any Australasian port at any time, free of charge. I soon discovered that taking the boat overland was a losing proposition in regard to its exhibition. In the first place, the papers would say nothing about my arrival, and as a consequence, the exhibition in Newcastle was a complete failure. Of course, on Saturday night, when the town was full of miners, a good many came in just to see what there was to be seen, and when I related that I had crossed the Pacific in the Tillicum, they told me that it looked very much to them as if I had crossed the Pacific in her in the same way as I had come from Sydney. I made up my mind there and then that I would never take my boat overland again to a place I could reach by water. I then prepared to sail for Melbourne. Shortly before my departure from Newcastle, I met my old mate, Mr. Luxton, who told me that the best fortune teller in Australia had asked him to inform me that I should under no circumstances sail in the Tillicum to Melbourne, as if I did, something very serious would happen. But as I had made up my mind to see Melbourne, which city I was informed was the finest south of the equator, I told Mr. Luxton that if nothing more serious than a fortune teller would oppose my sailing to Melbourne, I would certainly sail. As soon as the Tillicum was ready for sea, I took my departure from Newcastle for the Queen City of the South. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner Podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you are safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.